So part of that desire for closure you might refer to in one of your better moments as the noose of rationality, as you say in Floyd, page 14.
And there's a connection to Tether, because Tether, in this group of poems, dream and the relationship of dream and waking and dream and the noose of rationality is what I feel like I sit up into when I wake from my dreams and join the day world, you know? And so that's very prominent in Tether and less so in overtly in Float, but there's a moment where it is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Another quote, page 37, James Hillman. I'd love for you to read that. And it's at the very beginning of the, another quote right before that, but it's the second quote, second page in Orbis Pictus.
Right. And I should say that, so the first section of Float, which we've been talking about, or actually talking, having been, you know, taken our cue from, is called Conduction. And it is very explicitly a collage of quotations. Even my own writing, I'm quoting myself. And the rest of the book has other kinds of strategies, except that there are these epigraphs in Orbis Pictus that are directly quoted. And the Hillman epigraph is prefaces the first section or book of Orbis Pictus called Land Sought, Found, Claimed. And this particular group of prose poems, which is where Orbis Pictus got its start, take off from a volume in a series of books, illustrated books called Orbis Pictus, that was about gems and precious stones. And so you'll see the connection with this epigraph. I like to say that my father was an amateur jeweler and made jewelry out of really cast off jewelry that he would take apart and put back together. You start to see a familial tendency here. Mm-hmm. But also he would even use, he was a quality control inspector in aerospace parts plants in South Florida when the space program was big. He would take parts, these high-tech metal parts, home, the rejected parts, and combine them with costume jewelry and make these crazy, crazy things. Then when he moved to New Mexico, he started spending a lot of time in the desert as a rock hound and doing a lot of picking up of stones and polishing them. But I like to think that the gem, the stone that's been selected and polished, is the very paradigm of meaning that's created by changed context. You take this thing out of one place, you put it in another, and it has a meaning now because it's been dislocated or relocated.
Which illuminates your strategy in the book or part of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely one of my strategies as a writer. So this quote from Hillman is, underneath these humanistic, these secular ideas, there is an alchemical activity going on in the plant kingdom, in the mineral kingdom, as if the leaves on the trees just come out in the spring because they love to, as if rubies and emeralds grow in the rocks like drops of intense love, as if the rocks themselves are full of desire, reaching towards some crystalline intensity, some luminosity inside themselves.
It's really an amazing thought, you know, and I'm wondering how that force in your own self informs your life, informs your work. What methods help you contact it, and how does it manifest in your life?
There's a group of poems by Gerard de Nerval, the Chimeras. I don't know if you know them. They're
Robin Blazer and Robert Duncan had a big spat about how to
famous
translate
spat. I still feel that of all the translations I've seen, maybe half a dozen or ten, I still feel that Duncan really nailed it with his translations.
Right?
That's just a personal thing. I love his translations. I totally appreciate what goes on in that. I just actually gave that issue of Audit New York that has all their correspondence between them about that controversy. And Blazer did. You know, it's funny. At the time, he didn't yield. But when years and years later, when The Holy Forest came out, he calls them an adaptation. He finally either yields or over time has reconsidered, you know, Duncan's charge. But
long after Duncan's dead.
Oh, long after, yeah. And And I'm not interested really in that argument so much. Just, but one of the poems called "The Golden Verses of the Pythagoreans" begins with an epigraph in which, supposedly from Pythagoras, which is "What? Everything is sentient. Everything has power over your being." And then the poem, the Nerval poem, is really a very explicit laying out of this animist occult notion. I am so deeply moved by that. I, at the same time, and this is typical of my liminal addiction, my addiction to liminality, my desire never to exit the ritual process and actually come out the other side, I've never been able to adopt a kind of doctrine of, let's say, in Hillman's case, this is a Jungian or post-Jungian archetypal psychological approach to what he would call the soul and its connections and its resonances with the world and parts of the world that are outside. I'm endlessly fascinated by ways that people try to, because it ultimately can't be encapsulated in a formulation, I don't think. So like translations that I think have to be succeeded and superseded by new translations endlessly. I think also these kinds of formulations about what this means have to be brought, new formulations have to be brought. What I'm thinking of, and this I'm really free associating, but Bateson, of course, is another person who shows up in Conduction. But in Bateson, at one point in Steps to an Ecology of Mind, in this famous essay inspired by Alcoholics Anonymous, of all things, he ends up with a working definition of mind that is not confined to the individual person. So in other words, there's a mind, and it's an actual system. It's an actual ecology.
Not local.
And, sorry?
Not local.
Not, well, local, but not
limited to
bounded that. In the person, right? So my mind actually includes, not metaphorically, but quite literally, includes these things outside of me that are part of the system, the cybernetic cognitive system. Well, that's a sort of scientific, if you will, or philosophical description of something that maybe Neo-Pythagoreans or Nerval is also describing in terms of a connection that transcends a materialistic, mechanistic, even more importantly, mechanistic picture of what life is, what consciousness is. I will never be satisfied that consciousness is merely an incidental byproduct of electrical activity that exists and then doesn't exist with that activity, and that's the beginning and end of it. I'm just not satisfied that the evidence is convincing, and my own personal evidence is otherwise. So
how do you tap into that source, and how does it inform your work in your life? Is there a practice or a series of practices that you engage in, or how do you know when you're there? Is it like pornography? You know it when you see it?
Well, for me, if I were going to generalize at the risk of being a little glib, is that it's a practice of listening. And if I can make that general enough that it includes reading and includes conversation, it includes listening quite literally to the auditory environment, which I'm very focused on. I'm a very audio-oriented person, not just in terms of music, but even more general would be tuning. Attuning as a process is the central act for me. And though I don't have the closest thing I have to a pre-existing practice that I've adopted is the study of raga, North Indian classical vocal music. And that has been a great teacher in attunement, both physically in my body to sound and to vibration, and as a paradigm to my life as a whole.
Mm-hmm. There's a great quote by George Bowring, and it's just a page, and I think it's in the Vancouver Sun. And
okay.
He's talking
in
about...
the Vancouver Sun.
Absolutely. And it's you know, you could read it in about half a minute. But he says, you know, if you listen very hard, you know, stop your usual yapping and listen for what the poem is trying to say, you get a very happy moment because you get to be the first person who reads it. Mm-hmm. Now, this is very interesting. Coming out of Black Mountain and the New American Poetry, this is not a great concept. But the way he words it, you get to be the first person who reads it. But wait a second, aren't you the person who wrote it? But you're tapping into something non-local, tapping into something that is part of you, but as an extension of you, maybe. We wouldn't necessarily see it as part of you, that tree across the street, but we're apprehending it at such a deep level that we are, in sense, we are a sense, that's an extension of us. So you get to be the first person who reads the poem, a very interesting way of putting in the way we would talk about
that. Well, and I think that there's a question of how is the world in us? How are other people in us? Are they, or are they merely, do we merely, is it a situation where all we have of the world and of other people is these impressions they make on a screen, and there's no is it like a quantum barrier that there's nothing that one can know or experience about what's past that? Or in fact, can one, through attuning, sympathetic, you watch two strings, you're tuning an instrument, tuning a tambura, a drone instrument to sing with, and every time you tune one string, it changes the other string. And so they're not touching, right? But they can communicate through this medium, right? I don't think that our ability to describe, and that's all science is, our ability to describe the media in which we exist is comprehensive and thorough. There are aspects about the various media that we don't know. But we experience them even without before we know them, right? So for me, that's what all of this, it's an openness, to come back to that sort of theme, an openness in what otherwise is a very small and closed picture of what's real and what can be experienced. And literal vibrations of sound are a great image for that, whether it's Coleridge's wonderful poem, The Aeolian Harp, or Spicer's Radio, this notion that these things can actually pass through time and space and have an actual impact and travel, that they travel. That's something I hold to just as self-evident.
Yeah, they travel instantly, which is interesting.
Sometimes it's instant. Some of it's instant, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think they travel at all mm-hmm. levels of that. You know, mm-hmm. they also travel very slowly through other kinds of media too. Some things take a long time. Some things take more than a lifetime. What do you do with that? I'm in awe of the gardener, especially. I'm thinking of a big formal garden, a Japanese garden. The artist who, by definition, will not live to see the fruition of the work they're engaged in. There's another whole time scale.
That's open-ended.
I so admire that.
Yeah.